In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about success. Why is it that some people just seem to keep winning and others just can't seem to catch a break? Well, there are a lot of things we might use to explain the success of some individuals. Talent, perhaps, and certainly it's true that talent is required, but every once in a while, you do see a person who seems to have talent and yet is not successful. Some people would say, well, one way or another, it's all about money. It's being able to put resources behind whatever it is that you do, and you can't really quite discount that. But it's more than money, and it's more than talent, and it's certainly more than luck. There seems to be something basic going on here, and our guest for this hour of Focus, Rosabeth Moss Cantor, argues that it is confidence. Winners win because they believe that they are winners. Now, it's maybe a little bit more complicated than that, but that's sort of the basic idea behind her new book, which is titled Confidence. The subtitle is How Winning Streaks and Losing Streaks Begin and End. It's published by Crown Business Books. It is out in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. And she's joining us this morning by telephone to discuss some of the ideas in the book. Rosabeth Moss Cantor is the Ernest L. Arbuckle Professor at Harvard Business School. She's former editor of the Harvard Business Review and has been advisor to some leading corporations, school systems, governments. She's written a number of books that have to do with the business world, including Men and Women of the Corporation, which won a major award for a book that looks at social problems and others. So if you're interested in some of her other work, of course, you can head down to the library or the bookstore and as well look for the new one. And as we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line, so that means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free line, and that means calls on us, so around Illinois, Indiana, or if you would be happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455, or WILL, so the same. It works either way. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Cantor, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. And I guess that I don't mean to distill this down too far, but I suppose one of the basic ideas that you put forward in the book is that nothing makes a winner like winning. And that once, if you believe that you are a winner, that you will be successful, chance that will go a long way to making you successful. And that's perhaps one of the reasons why you do get winning streaks going is when people have have been winners, they've seen themselves win, they come to think of themselves as winners. That kind of psychology has a momentum that carries people along.
It has a big impact. But it's not just in people's heads. Confidence isn't just in people's heads. And its impact isn't just to think you're a winner. It's because it makes you behave differently. When people have an expectation that their team will win, their company will win, they will succeed, they are willing to put in the extra effort at tough moments, and everyone has tough moments. They're not only willing to put in the extra effort, they'll stick with the game till the very last seconds, they don't give up hope, and they know they can count on their teammates or the people around them. So confidence comes not just from your own inner belief that you can win. It comes from having a support system and having enough experience of success. I love to tell the story of one of the unfortunate sets of losers in my book, which is a college football team in Texas. Spunky kids who go out onto the field week after week, but knowing that their team has lost more games than any other team in college football. And what would happen is their cheerleaders would leave at halftime. So imagine that. I mean, here you would like to play the best game, but everybody around you has given up. And so it's so easy to give up yourself. But winners not only have the inner confidence in themselves, they know they can count on the people around them, and therefore they'll keep at it no matter what.
Yeah. This is, you're talking about Prairie View A&M.
Yeah, Prairie View.
Texas, the oldest black college in Texas, the second oldest public university, and actually a school that, if you go back into its past, and, you know, one can argue about how important having a winning football team is, but you go back into its past, you can see there were times that it were successful in athletics until they hit this patch.
Exactly. And I do love the people at Prairie View. There's a great new president at Prairie View. There's a new athletic director. And actually, winning on the football field was a little important because it reflected the state of the whole university. It isn't just the team itself. That's the point. It's not just you yourself individually. It's the people around you and your team, and then it's all the people behind the scenes and the rest of the university. And so when the university was troubled, having financial difficulties, not able to compete after the end of segregation, because then the white schools picked off the best and most affluent black students and also the best and most affluent and athletes, or gave them scholarships because Texas A&M was a lot richer than Prairie View. So all those financial inequities hurt Prairie View, and it all showed up on the football field. So while everybody wants to read my book to hear about winners, I also think we learn a lot from understanding what happens when things don't go well, because the impact of that, of knowing that you're going to get bad calls, you won't get the benefit of the doubt, your teammates don't support you, is that people behave in ways that make further losing inevitable. They don't show up for practice. They don't prepare for the big meeting. They don't want to talk to other people. They go home quickly after work or try to find reasons to duck out of work altogether. And so you don't have that bonded, cohesive team that can really get things done. And that's what happens to people who are depressed. What happens to people who are depressed or people who feel they're failing at something start withdrawing, and they don't do the work. And because they don't do the work, it makes further failure inevitable. Yeah. So now that's the depressing part. Maybe we should talk about winners for a while.
Well, I think you do pass this idea that it has to do with psychology and believing whether you can win or lose. In fact, really, the basic features of winning organizations or teams, and it seems that it's easy to use the sports metaphor because that's really, you are talking about teamwork.
Yeah.
When you look at the successful organizations, you see strong leaders that expect a lot of their team members that expect a lot of themselves, people who have a strong sort of feeling that we're all in this together, we are a team, and that you can't underestimate the importance of hard work. Winning does indeed require hard work. It's not just that we win because we think we will, that you have to be willing to go the extra, put in the extra effort, do the extra work, and an initiative is people who are willing to take initiative. That's also important. All those things enter into the mix.
Absolutely. I mean, confidence is not just in our heads. It's in how we behave, and it's in how much we're encouraged in that behavior by the people around us who will support us, how much our leaders support us. So confidence is this intervening factor that makes a difference in winners. But it's sports. I mean, I looked at sports in my book. I clearly look at a lot of businesses. I look at countries. I look at Nelson Mandela turning around the culture of South Africa. I look at strong leaders. I look at individuals who succeed. But I also looked at sports because you could really see it operating there. You could see why it is in football, for example, that the New England Patriots are real winners, or the Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, because of this emphasis on a culture of teamwork, rather than letting some people feel like stars who lord it over other people and everyone else kind of gives up and says, I'll never get the chance to do that. Or Dusty Baker is turning around the Chicago Cubs, and he also had to go from some stars. The Cubs always had stars, Sammy Sosa and others, but that didn't necessarily add up to winning. So I was really intrigued by sports because you could see these repeated episodes of performance, and I could test everything I knew from the business world or from career success or from individuals or from countries in sports, and there it all was. There was the winning teams were much more likely to have people be disciplined and professional and show up to do the work. what was said about the Patriots, New England Patriots last year, after they won the Super Bowl, second in 3 years, was the same thing said about the 1972 Miami Dolphins that had the only undefeated season in NFL history, which was that what was interesting about it was how boring it was. They just went to work every day and did their jobs. Winners do their job, step at a time, and that's what helps them win. Losers, on the other hand, often leap ahead and said, okay, I want to win a championship, and if I don't win a championship, I'm not going to do anything else, instead of just steady, day by day, doing the work.
It strikes me, too, that an important thing to look at is what happens, how do you deal with loss? Because you're not going to win every game. You know, you're going to lose some. So then the question is, what happens when you do lose? What do you do with that? Because I'm sure that there are points in which basically a winning record can turn to basically a losing record. I mean, things like that happen in sports all the time, and people will tend to point to one moment and say, "Oh, this was the turning point." And of course, it doesn't really work that way. But that, you know, there are changes of momentum.
Absolutely, and it's not just in sports. Of course, it's in life. I mean, life is full of troubles. It's full of setbacks and disasters. I mean, here we are talking a couple of days after the memorial to 9/11. I mean, unexpected and awful things can happen to everybody, including winners. And the difference between winners and losers is actually how they deal with loss, because long-term winners in their careers, in business, in whatever, will have a setback or a loss or a fumble. I talk in the book, In Confidence, about the Connecticut women's basketball team, which is national champions periodically. They're incredible. And how they dealt with losing their first game in 70 games so that they could handle the loss and go back to winning. They renewed their teamwork, and they renewed their dedication and their professionalism, and they didn't let it rattle them. They didn't panic. I'm afraid, unfortunately, Americans have been panicking post 9/11 in ways that haven't been helpful to the country, and I'm also afraid that the Bush administration is trying to play on that fear right now, when in fact what winners do is winners say, I can transcend circumstances. I have some amazing stories. A year ago, when the entire Northeast power grid went out and a large part of the United States lost electricity, most airlines gave up and stopped flying, canceled all their flights. Continental Airlines kept flying even through the blackout because of the incredible solidarity they had built, the way they worked together. And so they ended up, instead of losing a lot of money, as well as losing goodwill, losing passengers, they ended up making money on the blackout because they put out extra sections from Newark and flew all the passengers that were stranded in New York. And to me, that was just an amazing story of what confidence, when you build it into the culture, when you build it into the people. The people were so confident at Continental that they could manage to keep planes flying even when there was no power in major airports. I mean, that kind of confidence in the face of adversity is really what separates winners from losers.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Rosabeth Moss Kanter. She's professor at the Harvard Business School, former editor of the Harvard Business Review, and has advised a lot of organizations, governments, school systems on what it takes to be successful. Her new book is Confidence, How Winning Streaks and Losing Streaks Begin and End, and it's published by Crown Business Books. So you will find it in the bookstore near you, I'm sure. And questions are welcome here on the program. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I really should be preparing for a noon meeting. I suppose that would be better than taking the time out. So I'm just going to make an intervention and hang up and listen to the aftermath. Confidence is an interesting title because you've been on a book tour for a while. I don't know if anybody's pointed out to you that, of course, that's the name for a whole genre of police gambits, the confidence game. So it reminds me of the quote, behind every great fortune, there's a great crime. But now to my question about your methodology, you seem to be a little sympathetic to the economic dimension when you talked about the sports team that kept getting its best athletes picked off. But how do you separate the idea that someone who's from a higher economic class, who has backing and is consequently confident in some ways, that psychological dimension, from the fact that if he or she runs into trouble, they have capital to draw on to, you know, keep their gambit going, whatever it might be, legit or not. I'm just saying that this is like a psychological explanation. You just have to keep on the sunny side of life, sort of thing. When it's easier for people from a rich suburb to stay with good education and to be confident, and also they might be bailed out. So how in your methodology, if you have a sociological methodology, how would you parse that, separate those two interlinking factors out? And like I said, I'm just going to listen to see what happens here. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
First of all, great question. And actually, I've only started the book tour. This is my first day out on tour. The book only was published last week. And I am well aware of the negative meaning of confidence games, con men, etc. But that's not what I'm talking about. Also, I'm not talking about only the psychology. I think the caller is absolutely right that resources matter. And what happens is those who start out with advantages, if that is more likely to propel a certain behavior. Actually, I'm more behavioral than psychological. That is, it's not in people's heads, it's in what people do. So if people start out with advantages, they already are ahead of the game. If those advantages help them, economic or otherwise, help them succeed, this is why the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And also, as people begin to succeed, or teams begin to succeed, or businesses begin to take hold, it makes it easier to attract resources, investment, fans, supporters, investors, recruits, intelligence, getting invitations to places like my winning sports team in Miami gets invited to the White House. I mean, winners accumulate advantages. So I talk about confidence at four levels: self-confidence, confidence in each other, which is the teamwork, the behavior toward one's work peers. Then I talk about confidence in the system, a system around that in which there's accountability, it's fair, so you know that effort will be rewarded, but also that people will be held responsible for their actions, initiative, people get the resources and the tools to innovate and so forth. And then external confidence. It's all of those sources of confidence attract the external support. And so it is true that the New York Yankees are richer than other teams, and that helps them perpetuate advantage. And that's also because there is external confidence in the system. So that's why I keep saying it's not just in people's heads, but it has an impact on people. When people put on a New York Yankees uniform, they feel that they must play to higher standards. Of course, Yankees have resources that other teams don't have, and we saw it even in their practice clubhouse, which had many more advantages. This is why turnaround leaders, the guy who's turning around Gillette right now, Jim Kilts, the CEO of Gillette, or when Jeffrey Lurie bought the Philadelphia Eagles and took them from mediocre to being regular winners in regular season games, one of the first things all these people do who are turning around a sick system is they often invest resources in the physical environment. When I saw people turning around inner city schools, one of the first things they did often was paint the walls, make it more attractive, all of which makes people, puts people in a position to be winners. And then the fact of success attracts further resources. So I was really interested in these cycles and streaks and how our own behavior and attitudes are influenced by all these things around us that tell us whether, again, it's worth putting in the effort, should we perform to high standards, should we set high goals. And then when I did surveys, I surveyed teams and businesses that reported that they won all or most of the time or lost all or most of the time, or in the business case, they were their profits and revenues were growing or they were slipping during the 2 years of the recession, 2001 to 2003. And I asked them about how their work group behaved. And I saw striking differences. Every single prediction was statistically borne out that work groups behaved differently. And you don't know which is cause and which is effect. You don't know whether confidence produces success or success produces confidence, but it doesn't matter because they're intertwined. You succeed, you become more confident. You behave in ways that confident people behave as winners, and it produces further success. So it creates a spiral. So I think the caller was right. I mean, the economic factor, resources, investment, and that's true in the economy. When people believe that things are getting better, have confidence in the economy, they're more willing to invest. And guess what? The economy gets better.
Hmm. Well, one question I'd like to get into here is what happens with winning organizations when things go sour. And certainly, again, to stay with sports, you know, we've all seen sports dynasties, the Boston Celtics, the Miami Dolphins, the Chicago Bulls, that were for a long period of time seemed to be unbeatable, and then they go into decline. It's certainly that would suggest that you can have all the resources, you can have all the money, you can be wealthy, you can even have something you can fall back on if you have some temporary setbacks, and having all that going for you, even having the reputation of being a winner, it's that, you know, that's possible that somebody in that position could go into a slump, and then that could become a long losing streak, and you could, you know, get the reputation as being losers when you were once the kings of the world.
Yes, absolutely. This is why I devote a chapter in confidence to why winning streaks end. I mean, if winners have all of these advantages, then why does a winning streak ever end? And there are several reasons. I mean, obviously complacency and arrogance play a role. You can become overconfident. And when complacency and arrogance set in, what happens is that the team, the organization, the person often neglects the fundamental disciplines that help them win in the first place. They begin to take winning for granted, and so they stop practicing too hard. They stop introducing new players because, after all, the Chicago Bulls and others turn over many players every year. They stop introducing them to the good ways of doing things. They stop making demands on them. They stop being accountable. And then sometimes unexpected things happen that when the complacent organization or the complacent team wasn't accustomed to. For example, other teams get better and they become more competitive, or something shifts in the environment out there. I mean, the real dividing line, for example, when the New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles started their turnarounds was 1994, when the NFL put in a salary cap, and it changed the rules of the game. And so it made it hard to win the old way. So there's always change. And if winners stop paying attention to change because they think, oh, we're entitled to win no matter what, then they get into trouble. They get into trouble if they panic and start, again, forgetting the fundamentals. I talked about panic earlier in the show as an unfortunate response to 911. I think we have to just keep investing in our own game. And they also sometimes deny troubles for way too long. This is why big businesses will get very complacent. They'll deny that the Internet was going to change how customers shop, or they deny that their stores are getting a little shabby and need to be refurbished. And so they start to run down. And sometimes they don't notice that right away. And that makes it easier for others to start beating them. But they say, oh, that doesn't matter. That was just one loss. And then one loss becomes many losses, and suddenly they're in a losing streak. This is why Gillette is a phenomenally great company and a long-time winner. The Mach 3 razor, the Venus shaving system, they have incredible market share. But Gillette ran downhill in the late 90s for many reasons that I talk about in confidence, too many to talk about here. But they started running down. They neglected They neglected communication. They neglected the teamwork. They started discounting products. They didn't watch how the market was changing. They counted too much on foreign sales just at the time when foreign markets were getting soft. And so they started to slip into a losing streak. And Jim Kilts came in 2001, and he's now turned it around. So I'm also fascinated by these cycles because they can end. I mean, winning can end at any moment. But that's why we talked earlier in the program about how you handle loss makes a big difference. If you catch it right away, if you catch the problem, catch the change, you can bounce back rather than slip into a losing streak.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me again just very quickly introduce our guest, Elizabeth Moss Cantor.
She's Rosabeth.
Professor. Rosabeth. Rosabeth Moss Cantor. Is there an Elizabeth Moss Cantor that I should know?
No, but thank you for correcting my
well,
name.
Well, at any rate,
it's an unusual name.
We'd like to get people's names right.
thank
you. Rosabeth Moss Cantor is professor at Harvard Business School, and the book is titled Confidence. It's published by Crown Business. Out in the bookstore if you'd like to look at it. And we have somebody here on cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a few comments, and I'll list them off, let you respond, and then go back. One of them, there's a very famous article by the late Amos Tversky called The Hot Hand in Basketball, which is a matter of some dispute, but seems to show that at least in some cases, I don't deny what you're saying is going on, because I think you're largely right. But one of Tversky's points was that there's a tendency for shooters in basketball to think that they have a hot hand or they have streaks and slumps, and there doesn't seem to be any statistical evidence to that, at least at the professional level, which, you know, might be why. Anyway, so I'll just ask you, I guess my point about that would be, it's easy to see patterns because our brains are wired to see patterns, and they may not necessarily always be there. So I'll let you comment on that, and then I have one more thing about competitive markets.
Okay, well, I'm very familiar with hot hands and the hot hands literature, and that gamblers believe in hot hands when it's really often just random. No event is connected to any other event. But I'm not talking about whether an individual athlete can do exactly the same thing repeatedly. I'm not talking about those kinds of streaks. I'm talking about consistent patterns of winning over time, say over from one season to the next, so a team winning, or a person winning in things where effort really does make a difference, and where those advantages do start to shape how performance occurs. So, in fact, the winning teams or even the successful companies that I talk about aren't successful at every single moment. And so those individual streaks definitely are a statistical artifact. They're not really real. But for the team to consistently win, even under tough competition, even when they win by very little compared to very much, if you can find those. So the streaks that I looked at, for example, I looked at long historical streaks. Continental Airlines, you know, 10 years of losing from 1993 to about 1983 to about 1994, two bankruptcies, 10 CEOs, versus 10 years under Gordon Bethune of consistently profitable until the problems of 9/11, and then consistently ahead of their competitors. So that long period has lots of ups and downs within it, but it's a long-term streak. Or long-term streaks, we talked about Prairie View earlier. I mean, they went 9 years without winning a football game. And so understanding how that could happen, given that they had many talented athletes who had come from winning teams in high school, is really interesting. Or long winning streaks. De La Salle High School in Concord, California, I understand, just lost its first football game of the season. However, they had won every single game for 12 years. And you know that that's not just individual artifacts, that there's something in the culture that makes people rise to a higher level of play. So the Red Sox, for example, just had a brief winning streak. I don't take that too seriously. I knew they'd start losing. The question is, where will they end up the season, and what do they do year after year?
Yeah, as I said, I don't mean to imply that, oh, it's all just hot hand. I'm just saying one of the things is it's we have to be careful to avoid things like the gambler's fallacy and thinking, oh, I'm on a roll now, and that roll is three lines long.
Yeah,
you know?
But if you believe you're on a roll, and there are things that you can do to influence the next round of events, you're more likely to do them if you believe you're on a roll than if you believe you're heading downhill.
And absolutely. It was just a small little caveat. But the other one is in the case of, for instance, in the case of sports teams, one of the things, as you point out, you talked about the salary cap. I mean, it is in the league's interest to maintain competition among its teams, and so they're going to keep changing the environment to get rid of things that, you know, make it uncompetitive. Or basketball, when it got rid of the when it introduced the shot clock, to actually get rid of the four corners defense or offense. Sorry, it's been a long time. Anyway, so I think one of the interesting things about competition is that it's going to tend to erode the winners, if for no other reason than other people are going to copy what it is that they do.
Absolutely, I talk about that in Why Winning Streaks End. I mean North Carolina made women's soccer an important sport. And then their competition got tougher and tougher as everybody else said, hey, this is a great thing, women's soccer, let's have women's soccer. And you're absolutely right. And the competitive rules, we have antitrust rules because we don't want anybody to so dominate a market that they can then it becomes unfair for consumers. But in sports, things like the salary cap, it's very interesting to me. It's why I love delving into the Philadelphia Eagles in particular, because the Eagles had set a goal in 94 when new owners took it over to see whether they could manage to the salary cap, which is there to try to even things out, and still produce consistent winners. If they could do something in the culture, in how they run the team, and they eventually, in Andy Reid, found a coach who believed that. And so people don't always think of the Eagles as winners because Philadelphia is disappointed that they haven't won a championship. But they have actually won more games in the regular season than any team since 2000, including the Patriots. And that was, you know, I think a consequence of really great managerial decisions. So I think really great leaders, really great managers can manage around some of those constraints. And they're not getting advantages because you're right, the competitive rules are set up so that they don't have natural advantages, so therefore they're leading better, they're managing better. And that's one of my points about confidence. Leaders deliver confidence, and that good leadership really matters, and that all of us in our teamwork, our work groups, our organizations, or our lives can help shift the odds if we engage in the behaviors associated with winners, which involve accountability, collaboration and teamwork, initiative. And I think it makes a big difference. Anyway, those are your callers, by the way, on this show are phenomenal. They are so informed. I think it's wonderful.
Well, other people, if you're listening, you have questions, comments, you're welcome to call. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Rosabeth Moss-Cantor from Harvard Business School. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, on the Internet, and that's 800-222-9455. I wonder if you could give us a turnaround story that can talk a little bit about what needs to happen in a situation like that where you have an organization. Perhaps it was an organization that was very successful, had gone into a tailspin, losing streak, and someone managed to come in and change that.
This is the heart of my book in many ways, is how do you shift the cycle? And some of my favorite examples are Gillette. I will say a little more about Gillette. The BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, had was demoralized, and a leader turned it around, Continental Airlines, the Philadelphia Eagles, some individuals, and so forth. I mean, turnarounds start with a particular challenge, because what happens in a losing streak is that people stop talking, they stop communicating, they start covering up the facts, they don't want their mistakes to be known. And so the first thing a turnaround leader finds when he or she comes in to work with this is that it's always worse than they thought. I mean, there's always more problems, and people have just been covering them up and not talking about them. So it takes, first of all, somebody who's willing to dig in, look, put the facts on the table, help people face them squarely. And then the other thing that happens in a losing streak is that people get very demoralized. We see this in our own lives. It's how depressed people feel. You begin to feel hopeless. There's nothing I can do to change the system. My ideas are no good. In fact, in one company, the CEO was telling everybody their ideas were no good. He said, "Why do I have to have all the good ideas?" I'm sure we've all had bosses like that. And so people don't believe there's anything they can do to make a difference, and so they stop trying. And so a turnaround leader has to give them the permission, the will to innovate. At the BBC, the turnaround leader, Greg Dyke, found when he met one of his early meetings with his own executive committee, I mean, the people with power, they're sitting around talking about putting posters on the wall about the new campaign to change the BBC. And one of the executives pipes up and says, "Oh, they won't let us do that." And Dyke was astonished. He said, "What do you mean, they? Who's they? We're they." And I thought, the executives are so demoralized. How about the rest of the people? So he set up a whole program where people's ideas were welcomed. He put together big brainstorming sessions. They were all encouraged to take small steps, suggest small things, and they got some big wins out of the small steps. I mean, one young intern took money that was designated for a training video, and he made a video all right, but it was a pilot for a program that became The Office, which is their biggest hit comedy in many, many years. So people started waking up and taking initiative, and it made a huge difference. And I think that's a good lesson for turnarounds in any walk of life. I mean, people have to be able to face the facts realistically, but then they need permission to take step at a time. And as the organization or the person experiences a success, even a small success, a small win, it makes further success more likely. And, of course, my ultimate act of turnaround is Nelson Mandela turning around the culture of South Africa. I mean, talk about black-white antagonism, violence after apartheid, worse than our segregation. And he was a healer. He was somebody who was able to help people communicate across racial divides and see that they needed to invest in their country. Because the other secret of a turnaround is to have a common goal that pulls people together, pulls people out of themselves, out of selfishness, into a connection with a larger goal. And, you know, by the way, I keep talking about analogies to America. I mean, my fear right now is that we are so partisan. I want to see a leader elected that will pull us together instead of dividing us. And Mandela did that in South Africa, so he rebuilt confidence. I think in a turnaround, why I keep coming back to confidence. Leaders have to rebuild confidence, and they have to rebuild confidence in the outside world that their organization or their team is worth investing in. So Mandela in South Africa had to build confidence of the international community that South Africa was going to be stable enough, not riven by violent conflicts, that they could invest in South Africa and feel secure about it. And same thing about turnarounds of teams. I mean, the fans need to see that their commitment to the team will be rewarded by successful actions.
We have some other callers to bring in here, and next, someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. You used the word collaboration. That is such a wonderful, rich word. Could you talk more about that?
I think collaboration is one of the main cornerstones of confidence. Collaboration is when people not just do their work together. We don't all work in one big room where we're all doing a piece of the task, but it's where you know you can count on your colleagues, on the people around you, and you value their ideas, respect them. Respect is a very big part of collaboration. And I do know companies that have turned themselves around from losing streaks by, in fact, putting people in one large team across parts of the organization and say, solve this problem. No one group can solve this problem by themselves, but you can do it together. When Continental was being turned around from its losing streak, I mean, they had a bizarre behavior in 1994. Bizarre. For example, the people who were in the department that were making up the flight schedule would do a new flight schedule, mark it top secret, and then the people who had to run the flights couldn't get it till the last minute. And so they had to bring people into one room and say, look, work it out together. And I sat in on their daily operations meeting in Houston at headquarters, and it was amazing. It was like watching a basketball game as people passed the ball from person to person as they talked about how they were solving a problem, how they had already gotten together with another department and they were already working on it. And that makes a huge difference in success. Every coach of a winning team knows how important it is. They call it chemistry, but it's not just chemistry in the fact that people feel good about each other. They really bond, and they really end up coordinating their work. By the way, back to my sports, and since we're talking in Illinois, Dusty Baker and the Chicago Cubs, when he came in, people who played different positions at the Cubs weren't really working together well. So he had the batters and the hitters talk to each other, first of all, because they had a lot of information to exchange. And that sense that the team is more important than any one individual and that every individual has something to contribute to the team is a really important part of a winning streak.
All right, let's go on. And I believe that our next caller is also in Urbana, line number two.
Yeah, it's a really interesting show. I was thinking about self-consciousness and or self-confidence and then also thinking about self-consciousness and how they both seem to exist in inverse proportion to one another all too often. And it's all the more problematic because it's easy to confuse the self-consciousness with intelligence, which is an asset. I was wondering, do you see this on a larger scale? Is there an institutional analog to this sort of thing?
I mean, that's an interesting point to ponder. I mean, if I came back and thought about high performers in any arena, they are not they are definitely self-confident, but not self-conscious in every dimension. That is, they're not selfish necessarily. They're often thinking about other people and how they're contributing to other people's success. They are often also not focused on every act that they're doing so that they become debilitated and distracted. They've practiced and rehearsed enough that they're very comfortable with it. But they are very attentive to details. I mean, they spend a lot of time. This is high performers. They're very attentive to details of how they're playing the game. So the institutional analog, I guess, at a larger scale would be that you have to be aware of all the facts. I mean, I think there's a big push right now for companies to be disclose much more information, both to investors and to their employees. And, you know, technology, the fact that you can get it on the web or on your computer every day makes a big difference. And I think being conscious of all of the facts is very, very important to success and very important to building confidence, because if you haven't covered every single fact and if you're not watching changes, then it's hard to feel fully confident in all of your actions.
All right, great.
All right, well, again, thank you for the call, and we'll go to Chicago. Line four, hello.
Hello, thank you.
Yes.
Focusing on the matter of collaboration, I guess they're going to need a collaborative effort to restore the confidence of people that are in the Florida hurricane zone. We certainly need a lot of teamwork to help develop that territory again, if it ever will be. But going back to your individual matter of confidence, there's a negative aspect that people sometimes dwell upon over extensive periods of time. That's, things like anxiety, immature anger, inappropriate guilt, self-critical shame, powerless self-pity, and these are all confidence-eroding habits that keep us down in the dumps. And so it's recognize them and realize that it's a good idea to understand our feelings, and if they're of the type that bring us down, we shouldn't be acting on those and try to replace them with more brighter wit and purposeful outlooks.
I think that's an excellent observation. You've just described what goes on in a losing streak. Because as people whine and complain, as they it's harder, first of all, to be attractive to the people around you, so people don't want to be around people like that. And it also means you're focusing on the enemy, on the problem, rather than playing your own game. I mean, sometimes people are dragged down by circumstances. I mean, I'm not at all saying this is all psychology. Circumstances, resources, advantages make a big difference. But I think if people can learn winners' habits of mind, Bill Clinton is such an incredible example of thinking like a winner. I just saw him on Martha's Vineyard, and we hope for a very speedy recovery for President Clinton, and I told him that he used to say something that I thought was incredible. When the Democrats lost the 92 congressional elections, 2002, I'm confusing my years here, 2002 congressional elections, and many were going around whining and complaining and saying it's unfair and so forth, here's what Clinton said. He said, "I don't blame them for beating us. It was their job to beat us." He said, "I blame us for not doing our job, which was to beat them." So winners are focused on doing their job and don't get bogged down by circumstances. And just to make a comment about the Florida hurricane, we are incredibly all sympathetic about that devastation, too. I write a biweekly column for the Miami Herald, and I just got an email from the publisher saying how proud he is of his team because they have been playing through troubles. That is, they've been putting out the newspaper every day, even though they're scrambling, even though it's been hard, and they're just doing their job. And I think if other people focus not on, you know, whining about troubles, but rather just doing what you can to do your job, it makes a big difference, and it all adds up to success.
Then there's a matter of overly optimistic confidence, such as occurred in our venture into Iraq.
Oh, definitely. I'm not even sure that was overconfidence. I actually think it was devious cover-ups of the real facts.
Yeah.
But so to me,
and intelligence. Bye-bye.
Yeah, to me, Iraq is a major losing streak and a good reason why we need a new CEO of America, because you need to run a turnaround. Iraq is definitely a losing streak, but there is overconfidence. Yes, I mean, you can be arrogant and complacent and also feel you'll get away with it. And that, however, believe me, the arrogant always get uncovered at some point. So confidence is a balance. Confidence is what enables you to do the work, but you can't not do the right work.
You've just shown your hand and said what you think you'd like to happen here in November. I'm thinking about the fact that we are told that there are some small number of Americans who have not made up their minds about who they would like to vote for, and that here it's very important that both candidates are trying to persuade the undecided that they're the person who has the ability to lead the country through difficult times and deal with issues like the war on terror and the sluggish economy and so forth. So, I mean, they're going to be doing everything they can to convince us that they're the ones. This is maybe a slightly different question, but how does, if you're looking at some individual in a position of leadership or aspiring to a position of leadership, how do you determine whether the confidence they are displaying is genuine or is false?
It's a great question. I mean, my research for this book on confidence has made me speak out the way I just spoke out, because all leaders now, every candidate has read the research that says that the most optimistic candidate wins. So they're all trying to project optimism. But confidence is more than just an appearance. Confidence comes from accountability, collaboration, initiative. And I have criteria for leaders in my book. And if you look through the criteria for leaders who lead turnarounds and winning streaks versus people who are in power over losing streaks, the choice becomes clear, because in losing streaks, leaders cover up, make decisions in secret behind closed doors, never disclose the full facts, never admit responsibility for their mistakes, stay away from their allies. I mean, they're not collaborative. They try to do things like cowboys individually, and they make everybody else feel that they're too afraid to speak out. And so I looked at that. I was looking at that, by the way, in sports and business, and, you know, also Mandela in South Africa, but I wasn't looking at American politics. But when I looked at that list of losing streaks, I said, we need a leader that makes decisions with full information, discloses it to the American people, cares about our allies and our image in the world and our relationships with other people, and doesn't manage by fear, but manages by investment in a more positive future. And so that helped me see what the choice is in this election, and therefore the side I came down on. I mean, it all came from research I did for my book, Confidence.
At that, I think that we're going to have to wrap things up. And again, for people who want to read more on the subject, the book that we've been talking about is titled Confidence, How Winning Streaks and Losing Streaks Begin and End. And Crown Business Books, the publisher. Our guest, the author, Rosa Beth Moss Cantor. She's professor at Harvard Business School, former editor of the Harvard Business Review. Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Great questions. Great comments.